Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And Romolini, it's been a big week for you. Your podcast debuted.
It debuted. It came out. It's very exciting. We're going to talk about that. We also have slipped it into the EIF feed by this point. We slipped a first episode in with no ads, if anybody wants to go back and find that. Yeah, it is a big week, you know? I mean, what does it all mean? It all looks so good to the outside world, you know, every time you launch a project, because I know how it is when I see somebody launching a project, I'm like, oh, how did they do that? You know, and it's like, it doesn't mean anything. The joy for me, honestly, is the work itself and the puzzle of the work itself. Mm-hmm. But I'm doing a lot of interviews. People seem to like it. I'm really happy about that. But of course, in a creator economy and late stage capitalism, I'm like, well, what's next? Somebody hire me. Somebody fucking hire me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Scary. It's all fucking, it's, of course. It's like, that's the way it is now. 15 years ago, you used to be able to live a little bit better as a creative person, I think, a little bit more, with a little more security and stability. And I don't think you can anymore.
Well, there were decently paying outlets, you know, and I don't think there are anymore. And it's one of the things that really worries me about New York, because I think creative young people have stopped moving here.
I think you're right. I mean, I was listening to a podcast that was saying that creative people, it was people from Philly, and they were saying that creative people, a lot of creative young people live in Philly. And part of that is because they can afford to live there. But part of that is because they know they have a lot more freedom in Philly because they're not in that really competitive environment of mm-hmm. New York. They're not going to get chewed up and, you know, spit out. And I think that's a new way of thinking about work. I think that we all were like, well, let's get chewed up and spit out.
Yeah, exactly. The sooner the better.
Exactly. I watched part one of the Brooke Shields podcast last night. I mean, not podcast, the documentary. Yeah.
It's on my list. It's on my list, and I do want to watch it. I was obsessed with her as a teenager, and we were the exact same age.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was obsessed with her, too. I had pictures of her from People magazine cut out and put on. I made a collage of her.
Did you really?
I did from People magazine. Yeah, it's interesting because I had not realized that feminism, the second wave of feminism, because men were like, well, if you're not going to be sexualized by us, we'll just start sexualizing children.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I didn't clock that because I was growing up in it.
Yeah.
But if you really look at Pretty Baby, but I would even say more, the Blue Lagoon is just, yeah. It's porn.
Yeah.
It's kiddie porn. It's crazy. It's crazy that we let that happen.
No, it is crazy. And I think Brooke Shields is she had like the ultimate horrible stage mother who she's pretty, you know, decent about, still takes the high road about. But, you know, her mother was the one who insisted that they make a big deal out of her virginity.
Right. Well, I mean, it makes sense that you'd want to make a big deal out of her virginity. I mean, I don't even know. The thing is, what makes sense in this? I mean, to be fair, the mother was an alcoholic and suffering from alcoholism. So, you know, and sounds like she had a really rough go of it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's really interesting. And it's another one of those like retreadings of history that's been happening a lot more and more, you know, when we look back at like Lorena Bobbitt or we look back at Monica Lewinsky and we're just mm-hmm. like, oh, we really fucked those people over.
Oh, God. In the biggest way, Lorena Bobbitt and Monica Lewinsky are two really key examples of women who did not deserve the shit that came their way.
No.
And they were, you know, they were sort of bullied before internet bullying existed.
Totally. And it's scary. It's scary to think about. And it's scary to think about what we're getting wrong now.
I was just thinking that. Who are we coming down way too hard on, and who's getting away with everything?
Well, I mean, look at Britney Spears. That's not that long ago. Look at what we did to poor Britney Spears.
Yeah.
Lindsay Lohan too. It's just like, I don't know. I don't know how much progress we're making. Wow, this is a really positive intro that we have here.
No, it is. It is. I mean, some of the problem with like kids, you know, kids becoming famous is that they're kids. We used to see this all the time with models, you know, who would suddenly, they'd be very, very young.
Yeah.
Often still teenagers, usually still teenagers. And in an environment that is way too sophisticated for them, surrounded by people telling them how beautiful they are.
Yes. Yes. And that's their chief value.
And that's their chief value. And I mean, I can't even think of all the things that don't develop normally because of that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, I was, speaking of models, this has nothing to do with anything. I saw a video on social media of Gisele dancing in Brazil, I think.
I saw that too. She looked really happy to be divorced.
I was like, good for you, Gisele. Look at you. Look at you being amazing and so like so hot. I haven't seen her in a long time. She's so sexy.
She's always been really sexy and she looks exactly the same.
Exactly the same. Good for her. I was very happy about that.
Good on Gisele.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a really good episode today. We've been wanting to do this episode for weeks and we were so glad we finally got together with Susan Dominus. Do you want to talk about what this episode is?
Susan Dominus wrote a piece for the Times Magazine a little while ago that was widely shared about what people have gotten wrong about women and hormone therapy.
That's right. And menopause.
And menopause. So it's, yes, of course, and menopause. And so it's a really interesting and exceedingly informative episode.
It really is. It really is. There were points where I was like, am I smart enough to be having this conversation? But, you know, I made it through.
I feel that every week with you, Jen.
Oh, God, no. All right. Well, let's get into it. Our guest today is Susan Dominus. Susan has worked for the New York Times since 2007, first as a Metro columnist and then as a staff writer with the New York Times Magazine. In 2018, she was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize for public service for reporting on workplace sexual harassment issues. She has studied as a fellow at the National Institutes of Health and Yale Law School. Susan is also a lecturer in journalism at Yale University. And her most recent piece, Women Have Been Misled About Menopause, just went viral in a big way, or recently went viral in a big way. Welcome, Susan. Hi, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So your menopause piece hit a nerve with a whole lot of people. Can you briefly explain the premise of the story?
So the origin of the story is that Jake Silverstein came to me and said, I think you should do a story about menopause. And I held off for a couple of reasons. To be honest, and this is sort of the problem with menopause, part of me held off because I wasn't sure it was a topic that I wanted to delve into, you know, for many, many months and be associated with. And I almost thought, like, why are they coming to me with this story, you know? Why would they ever think of me for a story about menopause? But it's funny because my college friends, who were all going through this at the same time, basically said to me, Yeah, that's why you have to do this article about menopause, is because people don't take it seriously enough. And there's a lot of stigma around the discussion, or it's not considered important. And it is important. And I'm really glad that they encouraged me, because I would say about halfway through the reporting of the story, I did start to think, oh, this actually might be one of the more important things that I've reported on in terms of actually information that could really help women and improve the quality of their lives. And, you know, it's almost hard to find shibboleths these days. Like, there's so much information available on the internet. It's not always easy to find like big misperceptions about massive health topics. And yet this was one of them. It really clearly was one of them. So I started looking into it. And as soon as I realized that there were, you know, just anecdotally and through the research, it was clear that so many women had misperceptions about just how high the risks of menopausal hormone therapy were, I felt like the Times could do a really great service by elucidating that and clarifying the history of that for women.
And it did. It really did.
Early in the story, a professor of psychiatry says that the lack of rigorous research into menopause, quote, suggests that we have a high cultural tolerance for women's suffering. It's not regarded as important. This just feels so misogynistic. I wondered at so many moments when I was reading your piece how angry you were having to report it.
Was I angry having to report it? I think I was mostly fascinated by the story of, well, look, I will say that watching television, I often did feel very angry. I don't know if you guys have watched Better Things with Pamela
Yes.
Adlon.
Yes, we love Yes. Better Things, yeah.
And she keeps going to these doctors who are like, you know, you're in menopause, and that's where the conversation ends. And I even almost felt frustrated. I didn't watch the whole series, so I don't know if at a certain point she does decide to go on hormone therapy, but you're watching her live through this and suffer, and she's not even providing women the information. I think there's a quick conversation with a friend, and some people say yes, other people say no, but, you know, and it's obviously not for everyone, but the idea that this is a valid choice, especially for someone who is suffering as much as she was, you know, that she's going to see a psychiatrist when she's in the depths of menopausal, clearly she's going through a really rough transition. You can just, based on her hot flashes. I think moments like that were when I felt like, I cannot believe that even on this sophisticated, not angry at her per se, but just amazed that the conversation was still so under clarified, I guess is how I felt. So I'm like screaming at the television, like, ask her about hormone therapy, you know? and you know, I do think that there was just a lot of really just tragic strategic mistakes that the WHI didn't appreciate would have the impact that it eventually did. You know, the ways that they talked about statistics on talk shows after their foundings, you know, the foundings were surprising to them. But the way that they put that in context, I think, was not ideal. And the way that, you know, people perceive statistics is complicated. So I think I was mostly fascinated and at times also very angry and also very sad. I mean, I was really sad. You know, I think about some friends whose doctors said, like, oh, try this, you know, bee pollen extract. And it's not that they were on the bee pollen extract forever, but it was 3 more months of, you know, spending money on something that wasn't going to really very likely work and suffering for 3 more months. Or just the friends, I don't know, I had friends come to me and say, my doctor said I can't be in menopause or because blah. And, you know, it's uncomfortable to be like, okay, your doctor doesn't know what your doctor's talking about and you need to change doctors. It was awkward at times. You know, friends who, people really didn't want to hear it. It may be that like, maybe I come on as like a harridan. I don't know. But I mean, I definitely had friends who I knew were suffering from like, I mean, these are really good friends, but I knew that they were just suffering from like really bad vaginal dryness. And I would say, well, you know, there's this topical and it's not systemic. And they would say, well, but my mother, blah, you know, had cancer this. And then it's like, well, I'm not going to like talk you out of that, you know, and it's not my job that either. But I just felt sad that there was a lot of needless suffering because people had ideas in their head.
Now, how did these HRT drugs in the 90s were some of the most prescribed drugs in the country, right?
Yes. Yes.
So can you just take the listeners a little bit through like what WHI is and what happened? And
yes, absolutely. So what was really interesting is that in the 90s, based on a couple of big observational studies, which are studies in which they look at people who made choices on their own for one reason or another, and then they look at what choices they made, and then they look and see what was the result. So women who chose hormonal replacement therapy, were they healthier than women who didn't? And they found that, lo and behold, women who had chosen hormone therapy seemed to have much better cardiovascular health, or certainly coronary health, than women who did not. And because of that and other biological reasons, people really believed that hormones, that estrogen was going to be this elixir of youth for women, and it was going to be really great for women's heart health. And the risks were thought to be low cancer in terms of cancer, but it wasn't really known. And finally, the NIH, which was then run by Bernadine Healy, the first woman to run it, who absolutely believed that estrogen was going to be great for women's heart health, they recognized that looking at observational studies wasn't enough. So they did a big, massive, longitudinal, randomized controlled trial that was going to last at least 7 years. It was studying other things like vitamins and low fat, I think it was low fat diets. And it didn't find much helpful there. But so they did this big study, and they what they found after 5 years was that, lo and behold, it wasn't better for women's heart health for women who had uteruses. I know this is a little bit wonky, but there is it's an important distinction. Women who have uteruses have to take opposing progesterone to stop the estrogen from causing an increased risk in endometrial cancer. So if you don't have a uterus, you can just take estrogen. If you do have a uterus, you have to take what they, people were taking then was an estrogen and a progestin, which was a synthetic progesterone. Mm-hmm. So what they found was that there was an increased risk of heart disease, an increased risk of stroke and clotting, and also of breast cancer after 5 years is when they started to see a divergence between the placebos and the people who were not on hormones in the group that had a uterus. And it was very tricky because everybody knew about the WHI. It was a huge historical moment in women's health. It was the only large trial that involved only women, like ever, basically, to that point. Oh. And they had a huge press conference in which they said, like, we're stopping the trial. It, you know, these hormones, not only are they not good for women's heart health, but they increase the risk across many factors, and we're stopping the trial. In the press conference, somebody even did say, like, you know, for individuals, the increased risk is very small, but epidemiologically across a population, it will add up. And at any rate, there was something about the panic feeling, I think, of holding a press conference to say, we're cutting this historic trial short. Trials, for ethical reasons, have much more stringent standards of safety than a doctor might. So they're not weighing quality of life. That's not the job of the WHI. Mm-hmm. But a physician is going to say, well, okay, let's look at what this risk is. Let's see what you're feeling. Let's see what your personal profile is. And then we'll make a decision. But, you know, somebody theorized to me that so many doctors believed that estrogen, even with progestin, was going to be this incredible life-extending, quality, you know, health-extending, heart-extending drug. And they'd been prescribing it willy-nilly to women of every age.
Right.
One of the doctors I interviewed told me that she thinks that so many doctors just felt chagrin and shame and embarrassment that they had gotten it so wrong that they couldn't. They just went from zero, you know, from prescribing it to everyone to not prescribing it at all. So that's one thing that was important. The other thing is I think they didn't do a great job making this distinction in risk profiles. So if you're in your, you know, 70s, you're at much greater risk for clotting or stroke than a woman in her 50s. And so if you are going to have this small incremental risk, if that, you know, a small incremental risk on top of your baseline risk, if it's very low, is no big deal, right? Like women in their 50s generally, not always, but obviously they generally have a relatively low risk of breast cancer. So if you put a small increment, a 26% increase of a, you know, a 2% risk or whatever it is, it doesn't add up to a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you're now in your 60s and that risk is a little bit higher, or you're, you know, you're in your 70s and it's much higher, you know, that's when people start to get a little more concerned. Same thing for clotting and same thing for stroke. You know, if your baseline risk is higher, then the increase on top of that is higher as well. Just like when your salary is higher, the higher your salary, the more meaningful it is to have this, you know, let's say rate of inflation raise that people get every year. If you can think about it that way.
Right.
If you don't make a lot of money, that raise means nothing. If you have a higher pay, then that number, you know, that starts to add up. So basically for women, and there's another theory that is still a little bit controversial, but the theory is that if you give estrogen to people while their system is still healthy, and it's about to change dramatically, it's about to face this like dramatic ongoing total absence of estrogen. If you give it to them early, it'll keep the system healthy. But if you wait 10 years after somebody goes through menopause, now their system has changed in ways, it's aged in certain ways. We do know that women's cardiovascular health catches up to, it's generally better than men's, but the same age until menopause, and then women catch up to men.
Let's take a quick break from some ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And we're back. Part of the reason to use hormones and to use hormone therapy is to help with severe perimenopausal symptoms, right?
And postmenopausal symptoms too. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. But hot flashes, my understanding, because there were a couple of parts of your article that like sent chills up and down my spine. One was the connection between hot flashes and Alzheimer's, which was just like, what the fuck? I couldn't even, like, now every time I have a hot flash, I was like, is that my brain dying? You know,
we don't know. We really don't know causality chain. Right. Like it is possible that it is simply that women who are having, cardiovascular declines for one way or another, that is partly why they're having the hot flashes. I mean, Rebecca Thurston did say, like, if you're having a lot of hot flashes and it's, more than just occasional, but if you're like a super flash or you're having 10 a day, 15 a day, get your health checked out. Like there is a close association there, but whether the hot flash itself is causing that, it's a theory. And, I really do feel like the doctors were very interested in it, but they weren't even willing to like hint at and hypothesize about which way it goes. I mean, so I would try not to worry about that too much, but, it's more, I do think that women in general put up with hot flashes, much more than they have to also,
Right. But hormone therapy, just going back to that, is particularly useful for perimenopause. It really helps like balance out if you're having a very severe perimenopause, which I have had, and I have noticed that hormone therapy changed the game for me. I have my brain back. I have my, I don't get as many hot flashes, all of that. And I've talked to many women who are like, oh, but really you're on the hormones? Like it's still so prevalent. It's so crazy.
And on top of that, like another moment that really struck me in the story is when you go to your doctor, Susan. Mm-hmm. And even kind of knowing everything you do and being curious about the topic, like you still walk out of there without a prescription feeling kind of unset. Like even it's just so amazing to me that even at your level, you would go to the doctor and the doctor could just make you feel like you don't need it. there are women who are less educated about it, who've done less research into it. So I only can imagine what it's like for them when they go to the doctor.
You know, the funny thing is that I think that when women go in and they say, I do think that in general, and that's why I did think that the Better Things episode was so weird. But if a woman goes into the doctor and says, I'm having a million hot flashes a day, it's torturing me, I'm in hell, then there's like a little bit more clarity. What I find interesting are the women like me who are like, okay, I'm functioning. I'm not, you know, lying in bed all day, but I'm not happy about these changes. Is there mm-hmm. something I can do about it? Right. And I felt in that meeting very whiny, and that I hadn't met some clear threshold. And I sometimes wonder, because she was definitely my age. And I thought to myself sometimes, is she having no symptoms and therefore can't sympathize? Or maybe she's having like a horrible menopause or perimenopause. And so felt like, oh, sister, come to me when you have a real problem. I mean, I don't know, but I will tell you something else that I didn't even mention in the articles. I love my primary care doctor, but I spoke to her about it first. And she said, we really only treat this when you're only menopausal when you haven't had your period for a year. Meaning like, okay, after a year, we could give you hormone therapy. But I don't think she even realized that you could treat perimenopause because I think she just didn't even, she was like, oh, hormone therapy, it's for menopausal women and you're not in menopause yet.
Well, that's the other thing that's so, I mean, and you mentioned it in your piece and it's certainly gotten some attention before, just what they don't fucking know, what doctors aren't taught.
Yes.
It's just mind boggling.
Especially, you know, primary care, family medicine, that kind of thing. I don't think they have, you know, people, all of the medical school people I spoke to who were interested in this topic freely admitted that the training was absolutely inadequate. They had interesting reasons for why that is, which is that a lot of these medical schools train their students at clinics. And a lot of those clinics serve very generally underserved populations who are dealing with even more pressing medical, you know, life. Right. So menopause, one of the things about menopause, not life-threatening, really uncomfortable, but like their hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular, those are much higher priorities. So those tend to get, the residents tend to get the most exposure to those kinds of issues. But I do think that primary care doctors, family medicine doctors, even I think a lot about a friend of mine who had, she went through menopause, she was on the pill, she went off the pill, and suffered immediately menopausal symptoms, which she knew. But some of what she was suffering was also unbelievable joint pain in her hands.
Yeah.
And even though she knew it was brought on by menopause, she was still going to see rheumatologists and people who specialize in autoimmune disease. Like she was really worried she had an autoimmune disease. And if the doctor she'd been seeing had known she'd just gone off the pill and understood what that meant, because I think they even did know that, I think they would have said like, oh, maybe you should go back on like a low, you know, like a low dose estrogen patch and let's see if it helps the joint pain.
Right.
Because she was really having a hard time. So I just think that it's not just primary care doctors or family medicine doctors or internists who need to think about this, but orthopedists and rheumatologists and autoimmune disease specialists, neurologists, psychiatrists.
Yes, psychiatrists.
Yes, psychiatrists. I was about to say, because I really, you know, I've had my share of depression, and I really think that some of the depression I had in my 50s was absolutely because of hormones, absolutely because of perimenopause.
Mm-hmm. And anxiety, yeah. ADHD symptoms that just like really become much more pronounced, because if you already had like an ADHD that you were sort of functioning through with the brain fog of perimenopause, mm-hmm. it exacerbates that as well. So I think, yeah, absolutely, psychiatrists. I have a question, another question. Mm-hmm. Why do you think there's so much shame and discomfort about talking about this? Because I've even had this with like female gynecologists where they're like, yeah, it's almost like it's like a secret. Like we're using whisper voices about it. Why do you think that is? Is it ageism, misogyny? Like what the fuck? How are we still here?
I think it's just general discomfort with women's sexuality and the fact that they're complaining about the end of it, like it's unseemly or something. I loved the quote in the article, which I did not say, so I feel like I can admire it. But the friend who said to her doctor who seemed uncomfortable, it was a gynecologist who seemed uncomfortable talking about even the prospect of vaginal dryness. And the friend said to me, I was like, you know, aren't you a vagina doctor? I use that thing for sex. I respect the doctor I was seeing. I know she has these very intense time limits, but I just couldn't imagine saying to her something like, let's say I wanted to say, I've lost interest in sex, you know, that just felt like so outside the purview of what the emotional space was in that room, you know?
Right.
For a lot of women, it brings a lot of grief. And it's not that we think that estrogen like picks up your libido, but it does help with vaginal dryness. And, you know, people are pretty turned off by sex when it's painful. And that is a very common symptom of perimenopause and menopause.
Yes. And the grief too, it's really a time that nobody talks about where you really need to be tending to your mental health. I mean, what we were just all talking about. But because men don't go through this very obvious, oh, I've changed, I'm in another stage of my life, I'm having a physical metamorphosis, there we have to process our aging, I think, in a way they don't have to, or at least not until later.
I think that's profound. And I also think that women tend to think that whatever, and I think that the medical establishment often thinks, and maybe even have been better things, not to keep referring to that show.
Yeah.
But doctors think like, oh, you're losing your looks and your children are leaving for college and your parents are aging. Like, of course you're depressed, anxious, you know, don't feel right. I've lost energy. Feel addled, you're rattled, you know, and some of that is true. And that is what's terrible about menopause is that for many women, all those things do converge. I mean, I have to admit that I used to go on a run and there was a hill that was like just almost a little more than halfway through my run. And I called it Menopause Hill because in my mind, I know the timing. I knew that when I turned 52, my parents would be 86 and my kids would be teenagers. Like that's a lot to take on at once. And a friend of mine actually pointed out to me that when her mom went through a horrible menopausal transition, her kids had left the house and she was retired. You know, she had been a teacher, I guess, and she could like deal with it. But my friend had two young kids, was working full time, was now dealing with her mother. It does hit women of our era, I think, at a less fortuitous time for sure.
Well, right. A lot of times also it's hitting us as our children are hitting puberty. And I think that that is so intense to be in the exit when we're on the on ramp and we're on the off ramp. And it is a very intense time emotionally because you can really be reactive. You have a lot of emotional changes, a lot of anger. And then you have a kid who's also really reactive because their hormones are in flux, you know, like what a perfect storm of situation.
I think the piece was meaningful for some people. I can't remember who it was, but somebody definitely came to me and said, now I realize that that weird period of time that preceded the end of my parents' marriage, my mom seemed to change like almost overnight. And I now think that was menopause. And
wow.
You know, and this is something that when Darcy Stanky, who wrote a book about menopause, came on the show, she said really she felt good. There's so much shame and fear in part because mothers don't talk to their daughters about it.
Yeah. And I don't know what that is about either. I mean, I think it's what is that about? Because maybe it is tied to sex and sex with your father. And like, it's just, and also, by the way, I'm not sure women made the connection between all the emotions that they were feeling and that they were also menopausal. So maybe they don't think to say, yeah, I went through a really hard time and I'm pretty sure it was menopause. Maybe they didn't realize it. Maybe they just thought that they had changed. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's also mortality, you know, the last thing you want to be talking about with your kids in some ways is about being older. You don't want to like sort of trigger those fears in them about your mortality and at least for me, my kid, anytime they think about me dying, it's like, whoa, you know, you're getting older. I don't want to hear about it. You know, it's a really insecure and sad feeling. And I think maybe that's part of it too, but generally, I don't think we're open enough about our bodies and sexuality with our kids, even though at this point you'd think that we would be, you know, you think we'd be more open.
Are there countries that get it more right than us? I mean, I know that's a dumb question. Of course there are.
I'm told, I mean, I have read a little bit about this and I can't recall, but I think there are countries certainly where like age is, I mean, our country, I think in part because it's so hyper-capitalist and we're so marketed ideals of youth constantly, I think that it has to be one of the worst offenders. I do think that women suffer fewer symptoms in countries where the diet is healthier. And like, I do, there's like pretty good research to suggest that women who do, you know, improve their diet and improve their exercise will have fewer hot flashes. But I have no qualms about not belaboring that in the piece, because although some women do make that choice and they can do it, the food, the culture that we're in, it's the air that we breathe. And we, you know, there are so many good reasons for women to lose weight and exercise. And we know that it tends not to happen, at least pre-Wegovy, you know? And so the last thing I wanted to do is just give women more reason to feel terrible about their failure to control their own hot flashes. I mean, one woman, yeah, she said to me, the doctor told me if I cut out caffeine, I would cut out my hot flashes. And so every time I had a hot flash, I felt guilty that I hadn't managed to cut out caffeine. By the way, we don't even know that that's really a thing. And here she is, not only is she having a hot flash, but she's feeling like shame and guilt and it's her fault. And oof, like, I don't want to go there.
What do you think about, so the past few years, there's definitely been like menopause is having a moment, right? But it's like really in like the beauty and wellness. And like, it's like a girl boss moment. It's a girl bossification of menopause without really talking about like vaginal atrophy, say, you know, what did you think about that as you were researching this piece and sort of seeing this like celebrity moment of menopause, but is that going to change anything, I guess is the question?
Well, I think anything that increases the conversation is probably healthy because, as you have said yourself, like the shame around it is part of the problem. You know, it's funny because I think it's an absolutely valid choice if you're suffering to consider hormone therapy. It's also a totally valid choice to decide, like, for whatever reason, like, it's not for me. You know, some women just don't like the feeling of it or the idea of it. I don't like the companies that market their products as specifically hormone-free menopausal supplements, because that reinforces the idea, I think, that the hormones are like, oh, we don't want hormones. That's like EPA or something like that. We don't want to go near that. And I will give Naomi Watts, who has a new brand called Stripes, I give her props for recognizing that, you know, she obviously is not selling hormones on her site, but she does acknowledge on her site that that's an option for women. And she, you know, there is information about menopausal hormone therapy on the site. So I appreciate that. But I mean, the explosion of wellness products, fine. You want to like market a moisturizer called Glisten for women who feel their skin is drying. Okay, we all enjoy buying a potion or a lotion sometimes just because the packaging is pretty and it makes us feel like girlier, you know, whatever it is. The supplements, I think I have more problems with because they're just less regulated than FDA, you know, approved medications. And they seem mostly like a waste of money. And they, they've just been much less studied than menopausal hormone therapy, and they're not regulated and who knows what's in them. So
what would you tell somebody who's at the sort of, after you have all this knowledge now, right? So what would you tell somebody who's at the beginning or even at anywhere, any stage of this journey? What is your advice for women who are going through it?
Well, the first one is, you know, find a practitioner who has time and patience and energy and training in this, because there are sites that will, you know, Alloy is a site where you can like plug in your information and off it goes, and they'll spit out what they think is the great, you know, hormonal combination for you. And, you know, and then a doctor kind of rubber stamps it. And if there's something more complicated, you will get a text from somebody to talk to you about it. But I feel like the information is not as complete as you would. So for example, Alloy did tell me, based on my, you know, symptoms and period, the fact that I was perimenopausal, to go on low dose birth control. But you know, it was interesting when I spoke to somebody, an actual doctor, about it. She said, yeah, there's always low dose birth control. But she also said, how old are you? Yeah. Cause you know, it does increase the risk of clotting, you know, and she, just the fact that she had like flagged that for me, I just felt like I had more information and it was a better reason to remember, like, okay, you can stay on the pill for a year or two, but like not forever, you know? Whereas I don't know that Aloe wasn't going to necessarily follow up with me and say like, okay, now it's been 3 years. Are you still on the pill? You know, I don't know. So I guess probably you do need to renew your prescriptions and put in information. And I think it's very, very well intentioned. I just personally would rather talk to a doctor because and see the look on their face when they, it wasn't just that the doctor said to me like, oh, well, you know, it does increase the risk of clotting.
Yeah.
I saw her get like a flash of concern across her face, and that stayed with me even more than like the information. So it's just, you know, by the way, also Alloy can't insert an IUD. So they're not going to tell you for you, the best solution might be an IUD and like a low dose estrogen patch, which is a solution that, just FYI, like if you were going to do an ad that was like most gynecologists themselves, like a lot of the gynecologists I spoke to when they're perimenopausal do an IUD and a low dose estrogen pack.
Yeah.
So anyway, all this is to say that what I would tell people is find a practitioner, make sure it's somebody who's not twisting your arm one way or the other. And just like, you just need to talk through your risks, your family history. You know, there are sites that allow you to calculate your breast cancer risk based on your family history, the kinds of things that happen to you when you get mammograms, and what the age that you got your period. And so I encourage women to, you know, to do that. And, you know, you'd be surprised. I myself was surprised by how high my personal breast cancer risk was. And so it's something I keep in mind as I make these decisions, but it's just about being informed and making sure that you have the conversation. I try not to urge anyone to go on menopausal hormone therapy. I mean, it does carry some risk and there are things we don't know. And everybody has to make the calculation based on how much are they suffering, how much risk tolerance do they have, and how long they intend to stay on the hormones.
Right.
Can we talk for a minute about the power of the Times and doing a piece like this in the Times magazine? Do you think that it can be a catalyst for change, a big viral piece like that?
All I can tell you is that, so first of all, one of the reasons I really mentioned Jake Silverstein is because I think I'm very proud of the piece that I wrote, but a lot of the information in it is out there. It's available. And so what really happened was that I wrote, I hope, what is a very readable piece. And then Jake Silverstein put it on the cover of the magazine. And lo and behold, people, I don't mean to sit here and shill for the Times. Obviously, it's far from perfect. But I do think that it speaks to how much people, some people, perhaps women in their 50s, especially as opposed to women in their 30s and 40s, still trust the institution. Many, many, many doctors wrote to us and said, thank you. Or they said, I hand this out, or I have a QR code so that like my clients can like snap it on their phone and read it. I it's hard for me to measure the impact, but I do feel that it has somehow changed the conversation. I'll tell you this too, is that a dear friend of mine told me that his daughter at the University of Chicago read every word of it. And she doesn't read everything that I write, but she read that. And I love the idea of a 22-year-old, or she's actually younger than that, knowing what's coming, knowing there's options when she gets to it. Did you guys read that Sandra Tsing Low piece that ran in The Atlantic when it came out many, many years ago about her own experience of menopause? Mm-mm. It's great because it's Sandra Tsing Low. I mean, she's an amazing writer, but I'll never forget because I was probably 30 when I read it and or maybe I was 35, 36. I freaked out because she made it sound so terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And finally, I mean, really terrifying, like stark, raving, mad, like horrible experience. Yeah. Pause. And finally, at the end, she mentions that she took an estrogen cream and everything got a little bit better. But it was like such a side note to the bigger story, which was like, ladies, menopause is hell. I think many women, when they hit menopause, not only are they hit by like a ton of bricks of symptoms, but they're just shocked. They had no idea it was coming. No one told them it was coming. You hear about the hot flashes, but you don't really get it. And you don't hear about the brain fog so much. And you don't hear about the mood swings. And
I feel like I heard about the sexual discomfort like 5 minutes before it happened to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because who wants to talk about vaginal dryness? I mean, those words trip up.
And also vaginal atrophy just needs a new name. It's just a terrible name.
There is a new name. It's called menopausal genitourinary syndrome.
That's not better.
is it not better? Let me make sure I have that. Hold on a second. Let me look at the genitourinary menopausal. Genitourinary syndrome of menopause.
Okay, they should just call it like busted vagina. It's like, there's like, no.
Like my vagina.
That's exactly. This ain't good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this, Susan. This was just great.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Everything Is Fine. We're your hosts. I was going to say, I'm Kim France.
I've done that before.
I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it across the platforms. It really helps people find the show. It makes a difference. If you want to support the show, please join our Patreon. Throw us a couple dollars there. That helps us pay for production. It's patreon.com/everythingisfine. This week, you'll be finding our live show on Patreon, which is available only to live people who were there live and Patreon members, patrons. If you want to follow follow us on social media. We're at EIF Podcast. We're on Facebook with a private and robust Facebook group. We're on Twitter. We're on LinkedIn. You can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. You can find me on tinyletter.com/Jennifer Romolini. The show is mixed and edited by the amazing Natalie Rivera. We love you, Natalie. And we'll be back next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.